Welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm here today with Charlessa and author Stephen J. Carroll, who we've had on the podcast before when we were talking about his middle grade teen fiction series, The Histories of Earth. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, everybody. Nice to be here.
Steve's here today to talk with us about his dystopian teen series he just finished the last book for, called The City of Words. Steve, do you want to just give us a quick overview of this trilogy?
Yeah, sure. So it's a dystopian fiction that I started writing in 2015. It's not like far future dystopian. It's if things broke then and became dystopian, sort of the technology that they would have and how their life would be. So there's a boy, Alpha, who grows up in this school in this dystopian society where they don't have parents, and he has to like try to understand the world as he's being taught by the school where he lives and goes to school and doesn't ever leave. And in book one, he's forced to leave and he has to go find some place where they have new words for things that he's never experienced before. And, mm-hmm. and then it goes into book two and it just gets crazier and crazier after that. So the main theme of the series is if you take away people's ability for words, mm-hmm. they lose their mm-hmm. ability for all the emotions and all of the thoughts that go with those words.
Yeah, that is really so powerfully true. I have read book one and Charlessa has read through book two. And I will say I got this book a year ago when I was first thinking about talking with you about Histories of Earth. And I was like, oh, I want to read what other things he has written. And I started it and very quickly I put it to the side because I was not emotionally in a place where I could do dystopian stuff.
Yeah.
I liked dystopian when I was younger. And I think that for me, a real challenge is that most of the dystopian books that are written are YA and they're written for a teen audience. Mm-hmm. And at this point in my life, I'm a mother of teens and it crushes me to see them struggling in that world and see them in this twisted version of life when, as a parent, I'm working so hard mm-hmm. to give them stability and love and kindness and truth and hope. And then these worlds are the complete opposite of what my heart aches for my children and their friends. And so I had to intend, I'm glad that we had this podcast scheduled. So it pushed me into reading the book when I didn't want to feel that discomfort. And it was gruesome, more gruesome than, you know, Little Women and most of the stuff that I'm choosing to read right now. And yeah. It's definitely way more intense than your Histories of Earth series, which I loved. And one of the things I loved about it is how all the violence really truly happens off scene and is handled really gently for an elementary and middle school audience. But this is true. This is a true book, right? We talk about books that are good, true, and beautiful here. And true is often the ugly and the messy and the hard. And mm-hmm. we have to be able to face it. And we have to be able to talk about it and discuss it and wrestle with it. And I really appreciate how you did it in the book that I read in The Cities of World Words, because it's gruesome and it's hard, but it's good. It's also a good story. And there's a lot of things in it that I'm really looking forward to talking with my teens about. But dystopian fiction, it just often reflects concerns about the direction of society and where things are going. So do you see your trilogy as a reflection of current social or political issues? And if so, how?
I would say the reason why I started it in 2015 was I saw, I think that was sort of a ramp up to when people were getting canceled online for mm-hmm. things that they would say.
Yeah.
And it's not a very big jump from you're canceled online, you can't say anything, to you can't say anything at all, to yeah. you shouldn't be able to say anything.
Right.
And, you know, it goes down pretty quickly in those sorts of situations when you start to segregate people and sort of put them in a ghetto where they can't be interacting with the rest of society. Mm-hmm. So that's why I started to write City of Words. And then all the things that have like transpired since 2015. And yeah. There's actually things that are in the books that are coming true in real life. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't intended for that, obviously. I didn't know it was going to happen, but
unintentional connections.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the worst part about, I think, dystopian, when you write it and then you see it, you see little parts of it play out and you're like, yeah. This is meant to be a warning. This right. is not a how-to book. This is a warning
yeah.
book.
Yeah.
And you know, you just have to write what you felt like. And so when I first started writing the book, I just had an idea for the first scene. And so I got out of bed and I started writing because I just felt like this is the next story I need to write. And I just want to write it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't intended to do dystopian. I'm not, I wasn't really a giant fan of dystopian before. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really read very many of them, but I just was like, okay, this is what I'm gonna write.
Yeah. I think that it's going to be probably my youngest. By the time my youngest gets around to reading 1984, it's going to be history instead of dystopian.
Oh, yeah.
Watching these dystopian books come true, and it's like, no, these were not guidebooks and manuals, you guys. They were warnings.
Yeah. This 2015 is before a lot of things. Like, yeah. I think we can have like a recency bias and sort mm-hmm. of think that all these things existed for a while, but it's 2015 is before AI. It's yeah. before pandemic. Mm-hmm. It's before lots of things. It's before mm-hmm. like, you know, an influx of digital currencies and all these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. It's as the world keeps progressing, you want it to become more like Little Women.
Yeah.
And it's, and you're trying to push it back. And I think that's why you write dystopian, is to share these ideas with a younger generation mm-hmm. so that they can decide for themselves if they want to build their world into that or if they want to build it into something good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I like the thought of building it into something good and being able to give kids those types of roadmaps. Do you have any particularly poignant or that just jump to mind quickly historical stories that you love that inspire or highlight hope in the face of adversity and challenges?
I actually do. This is before I wrote these books. So like after I'd already finished book three, my grandpa passed away. And so I went back home to Florida with the family, and we were going through stuff that he had in an old like storage trailer. And my aunt was telling me a story about my great great grandpa. My great great grandpa was a Watson. So if you know that family name, that's the Watsons were the ones who built IBM.
Mm-hmm.
So IBM, the informational company, they started like a long time ago, kind of predated computers. And my great great grandpa was the brother of the guy who started the company. So he was working high up in the company for a couple years, and then World War II happened, and they wanted to send people over to Germany to work with the Nazis, so that they can use their IBM cataloging system to catalog all of the Jews in the concentration camps and all the other people that are in the concentration camps. And so my great-great-grandpa quit the company, stopped working for them entirely, and wanted to do something else because it's more important to not assist evil than to try to make money off of it. So that would be my historical point of hope, is that when you see something that's going wrong, you do what you can to stop it.
So that's beautiful. I love that. That's really good. I think that there's a growing body of books and stories that focus on the power of language in cultures and the necessity of preservation of it. So one that comes to mind right away is Jennifer Nielsen's book Words on Fire, which Inara really enjoyed, that's about book smuggling and cultural preservation in that way during World War II. And then Shield by Donnell Watkins has complete cultural preservation, where they saw the writing on the walls and started hiding the university books under their floorboards to be able to preserve their culture that was under attack when the war was over. And then into dystopian, I just want to mention this book series because I think it's very complementary to yours, but for younger readers. So if you are listening and you're like, I really like this concept, but my kids probably are not ready for the level of brutality that a teenager would be, but I want to look into this. There's a book series by Patricia Ford, and it's two books. It's The List, and then her second book. You can find it with two different names. You can, it come depending on whether it was published in the US or the UK, The Last Lie and Mother Tongue. So don't buy a three thinking it's a trilogy. It's just a duology. So The List and The Last Lie are the book titles. And those are a culture where they are given a list of words that they are allowed to use, and that's it. Anything beyond that, no one knows. And it's just like what you're saying. When you don't have a vocabulary for your experiences, you lose your emotional ability to connect to these things and to process through them. There was a situation in my childhood that has a very clear and obvious name for what it was, and I did not get that name for it until I was 36. And I had been through therapy for it and everything, and then two of my friends in 1 week referred back to this situation and called it by this name. And I was like, when the first person did it, I was like, no. And then the second person did it, I was like, why would you both think it was that? And then looking into it, it's like, it is that, and it's crystal clear, but no one in my life ever applied it to that situation and applied other words to that situation that diminished what it truly was. And so I think it's so important to give our kids the vocabulary for different hard things. And I think that's part of why even books like this, walking through these hard things with them, will help them to identify those situations in their lives and the lives of their friends, to help their friends have vocabulary for things that they don't. And then the last book is LMNOP, and that's three words: Ella, like the name, E-L-L-A, minnow, like the fish, and P, like the vegetable, but it sounds like LMNOP. And in that one, they start in this totalitarian rule that they are under, they start being allowed to use less and less letters of the alphabet, and that completely takes it from the first, it's an epistolary novel in letters, and so the first letters are written at like a postdoctorate level where I was looking up the meaning of certain words, and then by the last one they're using symbols and dollar signs as letter substitutes, and it's pidgin English, and it really just, it shows this complete de-evolution of their ability to communicate with one another clearly. So I think that in your book, in The City of Words, coming back to that, we meet this people group where they have been implanted into their nervous system with devices so that everything that they see is seen by the overlords, and also it's their thoughts are to an extent being cataloged, but also all the words that they speak mm-hmm. are being recorded, and
that's that, overwhelming. Yeah, I watched sort of the equivalent of like a TED Talk. It wasn't a TED Talk, but it was a presentation on new technology. Mm-hmm. And they say that exists where you can read brainwaves, but not implanted mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. through wearable devices. Mm-hmm. And you can interpret brainwaves and then see, like, if someone's looking at a circle, you can tell they're looking at a circle. Just mm-hmm. because of the being able to look at the brainwaves. This exists now, but it didn't exist mm-hmm. in 2015. Mm-hmm. And then with AI learning, everything goes a lot quicker.
Yeah.
It's a weird idea mm-hmm. to write a character, and especially what, 8 years ago. It's a weird idea to write a character that has to be careful of everything that they see and say and do, and nothing is private even by themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's that puts so many limitations on it that mm-hmm. Should I spoil it? Did I say how he gets out of it, or should I leave it for people? Probably just leave it for people.
If it's in the first few chapters of the book, I think that
we can
talk about it.
So the boy Alpha has to blindfold himself mm-hmm. to be able to go someplace that can't be seen.
Yeah.
And you know, it's hard, like, I think for kids who grew up now in our culture, who have been on social media for their whole life, and everything that they've said ever since they were like 10 or 8 or earlier, that they were able to type onto a smartphone, like that's all stored and recorded yeah. and all of their thoughts and all the times they took a picture and put it up mm-hmm. online is all cataloged. Like, I think they can understand more than an older generation, like mm-hmm. how everything you see and say and everything you do is being tracked, because they've been in that their whole life.
Yeah. I think in our family, we have a lot of sensory processing disorders. Mm-hmm. And so reading this, I was just thinking of how hyper aroused I would feel all the time just from having to be so aware of what I was seeing and the fact that that was being tracked mm-hmm. and only being able to communicate through touch in secret with other people, because they do actually something that we did with our kids was like, we would write letters on their backs and have them say what the yeah. letters were from the sensations. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how people are communicating in private, is through writing on each other's hands or writing on each other's legs or something. And so, I was like, I would be on sensory overload, just having to be so much mm-hmm. more aware of everything. And so I think that just added to the whole, this would be traumatic.
Yeah. And it also creates real big trust issues.
Mm-hmm.
So the main character Alpha has a friend named Theta, and at the school that he attends, and he's learning how to live in this society. And she's pretty much the only person he can trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a bizarre thing. Could you think of only one person in the world you can ever talk to, but you can't really talk to that person
yeah.
unless you're speaking in code, or you're giving secret messages or something. That was fun to write, but it's not fun to think about.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
I have a hearing impaired child. My son has hearing loss in his left ear. And one of the things they offered us was that I would have a microphone that would talk completely to his hearing aid. And I didn't want to do it because I felt like that was going to manipulate at times him, like saying, oh, don't go do that or do this or Corbin, come back here. So then personally, as we were talking about this and as I was reading it, I'm like, wow, how powerful not to have, you know, hearing or your senses in general and having to do that. So it did register with me a lot and those decisions we made for his hearing journey, because I didn't want to manipulate. I didn't want to be there. I wanted to be, let him make those decisions himself and not always have the control. So yeah. Yes, the technology is definitely there nowadays to do all that, which is fascinating.
Yeah. It's as if like this, as if the government is your parent, in this book, because you don't have real parents in this society. You have progenitors who come together and make a child, and then the child goes into the infant, the infantarium system, and then they get transitioned into schools. And so effectively, like, a kid who's born in this made up society has no parents, but the government, who is the overarching ruling class who's over top of them, knows everything that they think and could be like you, like a parent in their ear. And just knowing everything that they do, and if they step out of line, making them take it back or face the consequences.
Yeah.
I think that is a good correlation, Charlissa, because in these books, they can project images into the mind and make you hear things. And that would be the equivalent of you always being able to talk into Corbin's ear.
Yeah, it's like it's hijacking their sight or their hearing. And so, so with the first scene in the book, I'm not ruining it for anybody, is the character Alpha is sleeping, and his eyes and his ears are hijacked, and then he can see something that's happening and hear something as if he was there, but he's not really there. So even when you're dreaming, you can be woken up and see something that is what the society wants you to see.
And so, the power choice of words that they use throughout book one to book two, how slow and methodical they got when they had to articulate whatever feeling or thought they had to define that. That's what was powerful to me, is how sometimes we just use our words quickly and not methodical, and the characters had to be strategic with their words. Because one, they didn't always know the right word, and two, they were learning. So, and to show emotion, almost to show emotions through the secret texting that they were doing, you know, like sharing that they were doing.
Yeah. It's like if your teenager, was completely like unimpressed with you and wouldn't talk to you in person, but then they get on their cell phone and they talk to their friends and they open up. So that's sort of what happens when they can like be themselves and say what they want to say. So all their like big, deep conversations happen through handwriting, where they're writing in someone's palm. And then all the things that is like a open source where anybody could see it is what they say out loud.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And these do offer like, and I mean, this is what dystopian novels offer a lot anyway, is morally ambiguous and complex ethical dilemmas in what Charlotte is saying about talking straight into somebody's ears and what the book is doing with, you know, hijacking, as you said, their sight and hearing. So how do you approach incorporating these elements into your narratives of moral ambiguity and complex ethical dilemmas as a Christian, especially?
I just wanted it to be as realistic as I could, so that I could show, this is a society that could be built. Don't build this society. In my mind, I wanted to make the worst possible government that could be made. And then if it was even a little bit too nice, I would make it worse than that. The idea that was in my mind was Hunger Games, where they give people from these different regions, like, oh, you can train for this battle and you can come together and you can fight like once a year and you can get stuff for your family. And but a real evil society is not going to let you have a weapon and train for a year so that you can like come together and like, or, you know, it. And so the real evil society is going to be so evil that you would never be able to like have the words even to fight them. So that's sort of where I started from. And as far as like ethical dilemmas, I tried to give the character, I didn't want to make the characters like terrible people, but I wanted them to be real enough so that they could be like appropriately apathetic because they have never experienced like real love. And so, you know, when someone's in pain, like, oh, that's bad, but they don't really have the empathy for it yet. It hasn't really been built out in their thoughts yet. So I just try to make it as real as I could. And for whatever ethical dilemma the character would face, I tried to make it how someone, a real person, would react in a real society.
Yeah. We have almost everyone in our household has autism. And with that, some people really struggle with language skills. Mm-hmm. And so some of this vocabulary and ability to communicate is our reality when you're talking to someone and you see their eyes start to glaze over and you realize they just don't want to ask you what you're talking about. And so you have to be like, do you understand what this word means? And they're like, no, I don't. Like, I have no frame of reference for that word. And then having to simplify the language and explain what these things mean and explain how using words, how certain actions can develop empathy and can make connections between people that may not have naturally occurred to them. My 8-year-old and my 5-year-old don't always get along great. The 8-year-old's a boy, the 5-year-old's a girl, and she is delightful and annoying all at the same time. And she's incredibly forceful and he's pretty laid back. And then, but he just is so annoyed with her. Like basically Calvin and Susie, except there's been a lot less of the maybe he does like her that you see in Calvin and Susie. But he came to me yesterday and so Leora has four names. She has five names. So she has three middle names. All of our other kids just have two. And he was like, one of her middle names is Rose. So it's Leora Rose Serenity Jane. And he was like, does anybody ever call her Rosie? And I was like, no, no one's ever called her Rosie. And he looked like he was thinking about it. And I was like, but if you wanted to call her Rosie, you could. And that could be your nickname that you have for her. Mm-hmm. Just like mommy calls Inara Cat because her middle name is Catherine. And if you wanted to call her that, that could be something special that the two of you have. And then he's thinking about it and he walks off and like 30 minutes later, she comes running out to talk to me and she's like, Ever just called me Rosie. And that's so funny. And I was able to tell her like, this is because he loves you. This is him having something special that just the two of you can share. But I mean, those are language things, right? Like if we hadn't been able to talk about it and use the words to communicate all of that, then he would just have continued going around in life with his, she's just a nuisance to me, and not been able to show this sign of affection when he wasn't feeling completely annoyed out of his brain at her. So
and that's something that you can share as a parent, that you have the experience for, and you can like help your son understand those emotions and like what would be a good thing to do. Maybe you could call her Rosie because that could be a connection point for you.
An overlord government
is not going to have those gentle, like bedtime story conversations. Right. we need, everybody needs parents, I think.
Yeah.
That could be the summary of the book.
Yeah, I agree. And so along with, what is the summary of the book? So balancing hope and despair is a common challenge in dystopian fiction. It's either, you know, Little Women, hopeful, happy, basically everything turns out okay, or despair of this dystopian book just feels like it's sucking my soul and I'm never going to come up for air again, which is not yours, but like that's the balance of trying to find like where's the happy medium here. And so how did you strike the balance in the narrative, and what role do these contrasting emotions play in the overall tone of all three books, having not read all of them yet?
So I think that the hope and despair element comes when the main characters, they start to get more people in their group and they feel like they've created a family.
Yeah.
And so within that like friend family structure, they feel safe and they feel like they've been protected and they can be themselves around this group. And these are people that are on their list of people that they can trust, like their mental list. These are trustworthy people. And so it's not you by yourself all the time, forever feeling despair and feeling attacked by some evil society. You do have people around you that can help you. Like, even though you're still going through these really, really hard times, you can have hope even when you're being hunted down, because you're being hunted down together as a group and you'll be able to figure it out. Yeah. That was one of the things that my mom, who read the books early, like as soon as they came out, she's like, "Oh, I hope that it gets happy. I hope it is hopeful. I hope there's something there. Just, you know, it can't be all sad,
doom and gloom."
Yeah. And so you'll just have to read the book like to find out what happens.
Yeah, how that's not figurative either. That's literal for the books. There. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Alpha literally has a mental list of who he can trust that starts developing in book one. And I think that is, as humans, so valuable. Like, we were made to be in community. We were made to have trustworthy people in our lives, and parents, you know, when we have parents, that's an immediate out the gate. These are people we should be able to trust experience that he didn't have growing up in basically this glorified orphanage setting,
and like a boarding school.
Yeah. But I mean, being taken like as an infant.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And kept as an infant. And then now he's in this boarding school. And so it really is important for him to be able to expand that list of trustworthy people beyond Theta.
It makes him stronger and better as a person to be able to have that input, especially when he later meets people that are existing outside of that society.
Yeah.
And have like more of a realistic human responses, and they know real words, and they know, like, they understand what history is, and they understand what family is, and they understand marriage and these sorts of things. Like, it makes him stronger to be able to expand that list. And, you know, at first it was like it's a protection mechanism. But, you know, as he goes, it's good to have those people in your life that you really trust. And it's like, it's both a means of protection, but it's also a means of like, offering yourself up to people and you being that person for them too, and all working together.
Yeah. Characters in these dystopian stories often face choices between collaborating with the oppressive system that they generally start in and participating in the rebellion against them. And then your series takes that even further by looking at what actually sets the free people apart from the people that are in the oppressive system. Like, when he comes out and he's like, "Man, if I now, with the ability to make my own choices, still make these choices to kill people or to end their lives and take that responsibility on myself, then am I really any different than them? And so I appreciated watching Alpha and other characters navigate these moral dilemmas. And I'm curious in seeing the forthcoming consequences that they will continue to face for their choices. But would you like to talk about like that dynamic at all of what really sets you apart?
What sets me apart? Or what sets the character apart?
The characters, like what really sets the characters apart, like the free characters versus oppressed characters, and when they're compare and contrasting themselves.
So the characters that are under the evil government, the common, and you want me to contrast those characters from the characters who are in the free city of Logos, where everyone has words and they understand what the world is. So the difference is, the difference I think would be in our real life world, here are some examples that you could see, like someone who lives in North Korea, and they have only experienced this, they only get state television, and they have to like pledge allegiance to the main leader, or in some sort of society like that. They don't understand what the world is. They have food and they like their basic needs are met, but they're not a functioning like whole person. In a sense, they don't understand like what it is to really be a person. They're just doing everything to avoid being punished. So that's not any sort of like political thing against people in North Korea, but I'm just trying to establish the idea of like you have your needs met, but you don't have all those tools where you can like truly develop yourself and understand what it is to like live free and to have like real meaningful relationships, because it's all kind of being like squashed down. And then somebody who's like in sort of a refugee camp basically has maybe like it would be free in this scenario. I don't know if I'm explaining this correctly. They don't have hardly anything that they need probably. They're probably really in trouble and they need basic food and necessities, but in my imaginary scenario, they are free to be a family and make choices for themselves, and they don't have somebody who's like trying to come and squash them every chance they get. And so the people in the common, the evil government society, that's what it's called the common, they're living like very regimented lives, and if they mess up even a little bit, they get deranked, and they keep getting deranked the further down they go until they just become worthless to the system. And people outside of that system are just trying to survive with very little resources, but trying to capture in all the real knowledge that they can and like trying to build society in a good and healthy way, even though they like have to struggle all the time.
Right. So they're trying to build community when they don't even know the definition of community, but yet they're doing it the best they can.
They're basically like war survivors who have to rebuild a society, but at least they can go out and seek out real information,
right?
And they're not forced to believe what the evil government, the common, want them to believe. They can go find out truth by themselves. So I don't know if I really explained that the best with my analogy.
The whole finding truth is such a pivotal revelation that we all need.
Yeah, the people who exist outside of the common, outside of the evil government, they go out into the ruins and try to gather books and printed materials and things they can to discover what the world is like. And as much as they can without being found out, they want to try to learn what was before, the history of what the world was, and try to make something that's good.
Yeah, that sounds great. So as our world is feeling more and more like a dystopian novel, where do you find your hope?
So I find my hope in one of the Gospels, I think it's John, Jesus is being taken to the cross, and he's saying something to, you know, he's talking to people as he's going. And one of the things that he says, as he's being taken to the cross to offer himself up as a sacrifice for the sins of humanity, is, "Behold, I make all things new."
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I find hope in is that every government will disappoint given it enough time, or in little increments, or in big ways, or in small ways. Everything is not going to be perfect, but
yeah,
things are being made new, and will in the end be made new in a perfect way. So my hope is in a heavenly kingdom, and we make what we can on earth, and we try to use what we've been given to the best that we have been, the best that we can, and then just put our hope in what can't be taken away.
Yeah.
So that's where I also, you know, I hope for good things. I'm not like a fatalist. I hope for good things on the earth, but you know, like, and in all sense, like my hope is in a new perfect kingdom in heaven.
Mended wood.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So along the lines of not being a fatalist, how do you see creativity, whether in art, literature, other forms, contributing and fostering hope in individuals and society? What role do you see it playing?
So there's, you guys know how things used to be back before Google,
mm-hmm.
like where you would have to think about something and be like, is that really what it was? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. And then like you might have an encyclopedia, or you might be able to go to a library, or you might have a book on the subject, but you'd have to like work it out with people. And
yeah.
Be like, I don't know if that's really what it was. And then you'd have to like discuss it, and you didn't have the arbitrator of Google to be like, oh, see, this is what Google says. This is what
mm-hmm.
it is. And so, but now we've sort of like diminished that ability to like hold information.
Yeah.
In like a deep sense, it's like on a computer, you have memory that is being stored, and it's the way a computer works is it's like this random memory that gets wiped over all the time, and you have memory that's deep in your storage.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we as a society have sort of like lessened our storage memory mm-hmm. in favor of like mm-hmm. uploading all of our memory to the cloud, basically. Mm-hmm. And we, mm-hmm. you know, we are like, we've offloaded that part of our memory. Cause you know, you don't have to worry about like how to get to the local bookstore. You don't have to remember how to get there because you've always looked at the GPS
right.
and you can like, you'll be able to get there cause you have your phone. Mm-hmm. So I think the role of creativity, is like, it's deepening our ability to create. And it gives hope because people that can create really great things. You know, like where Google sort of like took over our ability for keeping information, you know, AI in this new era is like
mm-hmm.
taking
mm-hmm.
over creativity. And so yeah. you can offload, so you can, you know, never have to like paint a new picture because you can ask AI to paint a picture about mm-hmm. such and such mm-hmm. a thing. Or like make a picture of such and such a thing, or write a story in the voice styling of Stephen J. Carroll,
yeah.
something that he would write. And read that book. But I think there's something like really really deep and hopeful about actual creativity and, and not like offloaded creativity. Because when you're really being creative, you're doing the sorts of things that you were meant to do.
Yeah.
Like you were meant to be a creative thing. And I believe in God's image, who is a creative God. And so you are doing the thing that you were meant to do is be creative. In whatever way that looks, you know, I mean, some people are creative in architecture and some people are creative in law and some people are creative in other ways. It doesn't just have to be, in the arts. But I think creativity is helpful because it has the ability to make us better people. Cause we can think about deeper things and not offload that creativity to something else or someone else. Like, you know, you could be a person that always only watches Netflix and never tries to create something yourself. And it diminishes your ability to think deeply enough to create something of your own.
Yeah.
So I just, creativity is helpful for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree. I love that. I love watching my kids be creative in a million different ways. I don't know why, but I'm just thinking of my son standing at the street with a sign on a cardboard box he made that said, "I need chalk." And he was holding it up to passing cars. And we were like, "Wait, no, we have chalk in the garage. You don't need to be panhandling for chalk." But then we gave him chalk and he just like went to town, and all of a sudden, like, the whole driveway and all the sidewalks up and down the street were just covered in Charlie Brown scenes.
He knew how to get you to give him chalk. That's what it was.
Well, he came in and got me to give him cardboard first. And now we always know to ask what he wants cardboard for. But yeah, but creativity is definitely a gift. And I do definitely see that difference in the Google brain between my generation and my kids' generation, where I feel like it removes this step of wonder, right? When I was a kid, we didn't have an encyclopedia set. So I would wonder about something for a few days until we got to the library. And then I would go find books to look up the answer to my, my query. But it just gives you time to think about it and all of that. I spoke at a Charlotte Mason homeschool conference this weekend, and Charlotte Mason was a educator and educator of educators in the 1800s. And my topic was, what is a living book? And Charlotte had more than enough to say on the topic. And I took all of her quotes and put them into ChatGPT and told ChatGPT to give me a talk intro written in her voice, just like what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And it was the funniest thing to see what this modern ChatGPT was able to do with this refined woman from the 1800s. And it was kind of comical because I think it kind of combined her voice with my voice. And so at one point she's like, "Yeah, this is a call to arms." And I was like, "Oh my gosh," she would not have been saying that at all.
Yeah.
But it is really scary what AI is able to do. And I did appreciate in your books the absence of AI being written pre-AI.
Yeah.
Like it did kind of show all the abilities for technological advances that were available then. But I feel like everything is AI anymore. Like you can't read anything without AI being in it if you're looking at sci-fi or dystopian. Yeah. So this was kind of,
it's just far enough back to be more relevant for like modern talk times.
Yeah.
And then, but back far enough so you don't have to deal with AI.
So I think something that I like to compare and contrast with certain books is whether or not they're equally good in book form as they are on audiobook. So Element OP that I was talking about earlier really needs to be read with the eyes because
you have to see the language changing. Mm-hmm. In City of Words, I listened to book one on audiobook and I listened to it slightly sped up. And I almost think the more frantic pace of the reader fit really well with the pace of the story.
Oh, yeah.
By the end of it, I was like, oh, I need to slow it down just so I know like what the reader's cadence actually would have been at normal speed. And I was like, yeah, no, I think listening to it in panic mode was really the way to go.
Yeah, but is there
anything
mode.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything in book two or book three where visually it's better to see the pages, or is this one where we can say, hey, once again, you picked a great reader? And
I think the reader is really good. Mm-hmm. So I think book one and book two can be done in audiobook form. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, might be scarier in audiobook mm-hmm. form. I don't know, just because the reader's voice.
Charlissa, didn't you tell me you didn't think you could listen to it?
No, I did, and I listen fast usually. I read both book one and two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I also read frantically, knowing that I was coming online to read. My daughter just asked me before I walked in, what's the book about? I'm like, I don't have time to tell you. Like,
you know. Yeah. But, you know, at least you finished it.
I did.
And book three isn't an audiobook yet. And I think it has a possibility to be. But mm-hmm. there's some formatting things, like some of the text is bolded mm-hmm. to indicate like this is emphasized.
Yeah.
And it's hard to read that because it has to do with how they're speaking in code. And so like mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to understand it really if you're not reading it on paper.
Right.
So I could get book three made into an audiobook, and then it just doesn't display, it doesn't fully describe that scene mm-hmm. as well as it could, but I don't know, it's mm-hmm. it's up in the air for me yet.
Yeah. Well, we love our dyslexic readers around here, and I'm always excited when they do have the option of mm-hmm. listening to a book that may not have been accessible for them if they were required to use their eyes to read it. So
yeah.
I think that they would probably rather hear book three not.
Yeah. My plan is to get book three into an audiobook form in the not so distant future. So
yeah,
that's my hope.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us about these books. This is our first real highlight of dystopian fiction again, because I'm the host and I just don't really have the stomach for it as much as I used to, but Inara is definitely moving in that direction of interest. So I'm sure we will be having more conversations about these books, but I also think that this was really good. I thought that it did have that good balance of hope that, mm-hmm. that my mama's heart needed. And I know that, I know Inara will really enjoy it when I give it to her to read. So thank you for sharing that.
And I think I would probably distinguish this book between like a YA dystopian, and mm-hmm. I would push it more towards like a teen dystopian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't really have like all of the romance in there.
Right.
And it's mm-hmm. not inappropriate in like a physical relationship between two people, sort of they have appropriate relationships.
Yeah.
And even though everything is murder and mayhem around them,
right.
at least they're not doing things that they shouldn't. So it's
creating their own morality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is it's more of a more moral dystopian. So I would say that if you're going to read a dystopian and you're worried, are you, your kid is going to read a dystopian,
mm-hmm.
They should be, for this book, they should be able to process the gruesomeness of it. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily have to worry about suggestive content, because it's, mm-hmm. it's all mm-hmm. appropriate in that sense. It's just the world sometimes is bloody and mean. And so it has those elements, but it doesn't have the elements that you would probably want to not have them read at all. So,
right.
Yeah. That's good.
So there's the cruelty level that exists in these dystopian worlds, but no smut.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's a non-smut book.
So thank you so much. And we appreciate talking to you and look forward to what, or do you have another series lined up? I was going to say to what you write next, but are you, do you have works in the progress?
I actually do have, I started like about a week ago and I'm like 7,000 words in.
Nice.
So I'm that's already, awesome. Yeah, it, I think it's going to be really good. I think it's
going to,
it's like a mix of, City of Words and Histories of Earth.
Nice.
So it would be if you mix those two together.
Pretty cool.
Yay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You heard it first here, folks. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking. And all these books will be in our show notes. And they're also available on Amazon under author Stephen J. Carroll, Stephen with a V. Mm-hmm. And Amazon really does not like you because you have to like put in your whole name mm-hmm. and the title of the book 9 times out of 10 to find your books, which drives me crazy. Mm-hmm. It's that AI trying to think it knows what I want. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
So easiest way will probably be the links from our show notes. And we look forward to talking to you again soon. And remember, everyone, the stories are truer than true. Mm-hmm.